What do an international trade war and an international spat about defense spending have in common? One American president. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, July 11th. Thanks for joining us today. We begin with, and this should not be a surprise, tariffs and trade. We have been talking and talking about a potential trade war and how it could get out of hand and what it might mean. But did it just get really real? Last night, the Trump administration announced its tariffs on China would increase fivefold. And no surprise here either, Beijing said it would respond in kind. And increasingly, economists and market signals suggest actual, tangible effects, like the kind you may start to notice. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The current tariffs against Chinese imports hit industrial innards. Compressors, engine parts, boring machines. Yeah, boring. But round two, if it happens, taxes Chinese fridges, furniture, seafood, about half of everything China sends here.
This is a new ballgame.
That's economist Lynn Reeser at Point Loma Nazarene University in San Diego. To her, falling commodity and metals prices today suggest factory slowdowns are coming because of tariffs. And the dollar is up, making U.S. exports expensive and less competitive.
We're also going to be fighting against slower growth overseas, so it's going to be a harder road for exporters in the next several months.
Big investments by U.S. companies are being scaled back or delayed by trade uncertainty. That's according to the latest Federal Reserve meeting minutes. And here's the math. When you add up the threatened tariffs coming from the U.S., China, Europe, and everywhere, global risk has really stepped up, says Adam Slater at Oxford Economics.
We're talking about $800 billion worth of world trade being affected by high tariffs.
He says that helps explain some global market wooziness we're seeing today. But economist Mickey Levy at Berenberg Capital Markets says investors can overreact.
And when they see an unfavorable headline about new proposed tariffs, they shift gears. But you know, the underlying economic and profit fundamentals are positive.
Things could stay that way. But others see this trade spat at or near an economic turning point. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you think the conversations over tariffs have been testy, I mean, remember when Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said that Canada would not be pushed around? Well, you should have seen the pushing around in Brussels, Belgium today, the first day of a summit of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. At a breakfast meeting, the president slammed other members of the military alliance for not spending enough on defense.
In many countries owe us a tremendous amount of money from many years back where they're delinquent, as far as I'm concerned, because the United States has had to pay for them.
And that was just at the photo op. Here with more on the NATO summit is Marketplace European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Molly.
Stephen, tell us, how are relations? I mean, how did they, you know, these were very blunt words delivered by President Trump. How did they go down with other NATO members?
Well, it was pretty bruising stuff, even by President Trump's standards. But I think, you know, to some extent, the other leaders arrived in Brussels already in the brace position. They knew an onslaught was coming, and come it did. President Trump has made pretty clear the U.S. is very dissatisfied and has been for many years about the huge disparity in defense spending. There's no doubt that the U.S. Accounts for the lion's share of the alliance's total defense spend, something like 70%. So, you know, many analysts say the U.S. is quite right to feel aggrieved. Nevertheless, things are changing. The European allies are beginning to spend more on defense, in some cases a lot more. Germany, in fact, has increased its defense budget by 30% over the past 4 years. Analysts say that President Trump can claim some credit for this increase.
Well, and let's talk about Germany for a moment, because not only did the president have strong words for Germany, it raised this kind of other issue that's been, it sounds like, bubbling up for a while. Let's hear first what he said.
Germany is totally controlled by Russia because they will be getting from 60 to 70% of their energy from Russia and a new pipeline. And you tell me if that's appropriate, because I think it's not. And I think it's a very bad thing for NATO.
So what is this pipeline that President Trump talked about, and why is it such a source of irritation?
This new pipeline bypasses Poland and Ukraine to get Russian gas directly into Western Europe. Trump says this pipeline puts Germany under Putin's thumb and means Germany will pour billions of euros into Russian coffers, while NATO and particularly the US has to spend billions defending Europe against the Russians. So he thinks it's a kind of Russian bridgehead into Europe, breaching NATO defences.
You know, there are these two things happening somewhat simultaneously in which the president is playing the role of bull in the China shop. And those are trade negotiations and then, of course, these defence conversations. Are they related in some way? What is the bigger picture here?
Technically, they should not be related, but they are politically and emotionally intertwined. It was very noticeable that in his various public comments today in Brussels, President Trump talked not only about defence spending, but also trade, and talked about increases in both. So I think as far as President Trump is concerned, yes, there is a connection, and there is particularly for the president a concern about Germany, which he sees as a country which a major exporting country with a huge surplus on its trading account, which is sitting back and benefiting from the security shield provided at great expense by American taxpayers.
Stephen Beard is Marketplace's European Bureau Chief. Stephen, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Molly.
On Wall Street today, markets seem to think things are getting real in the trade war, and they don't like it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. More on the tariff fallout that isn't really bad news. When the U.S. proposed adding this other $200 billion in tariffs on Chinese goods this week, it included a few, let's say, questionable items like live trout, radio tape players, and liquefied natural gas. Now, tariffs on those items might hurt China if the U.S. actually imported any of them, but we don't. China sends none of those items to the U.S. And when it comes to liquefied natural gas in particular, or LNG, as those in the know call it, China's actually really interested in our gas, so much so that LNG could be one American export that could bypass tariffs. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more.
Natural gas is so popular that the Panama Canal is rushing to double the number of slots it gives to LNG tankers. The canal will also let more of them pass through at the same time, even at night. Silvia De Marucci handles market research for the canal.
We know that volumes of LNG from the United States are going to increase.
New natural gas plants have been popping up all along the U.S. Gulf Coast in recent years.
All the new LNG projects are pretty much gearing up to supply China.
Energy analyst Barbara Shook. China's in the middle of a nationwide shift toward cleaner products like LNG. Shook says that's poised to make the U.S. a top LNG exporter.
It certainly helps improve the U.S. balance of trade.
China's been signing deals with suppliers in Gulf Coast states to import more gas. Damian Ma at the University of Chicago says at a time when trade tensions between the U.S. and China are high, the free flow of LNG has a benefit.
That's going to probably offer some countervailing forces to what's happening between Washington and Beijing.
So far, China has not levied tariffs on natural gas. Ma says China could look elsewhere if things escalate. But Barbara Shook says China is hungry for LNG, and the U.S. has a lot of it.
The United States is blessed with so much natural gas. I mean, we're talking about decades, if not centuries, worth of natural gas.
Which could give the U.S. a powerful tool in geopolitics. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Okay, enough trade talk. How's that workday going? Good? Bad? Ready to walk out in a huff? Well, if you did, you wouldn't be alone. More Americans are quitting their jobs nowadays. The latest numbers out from the Labor Department show that in May, the most recent batch of data available, the so-called quits rate hit its highest level since 2001. That tells us that, at least in some sectors, people feel good enough about the economy to dump that old job and take a chance on a new gig. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports from Washington that it also tells us something about wages.
These numbers came out in the monthly Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, casually known by the people who talk about this sort of thing casually as the JOLTS report. Kate Bonn is an economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
So what the JOLTS tells us is how much turnover there is in the labor market. And so that is quit rates, hiring rates, and open vacancies that employers are trying to fill.
Unemployment is already low, but wages aren't really growing. So when bosses won't give raises and there are a ton of open jobs on the market, people quit, sometimes with enticement, says Andrew Chamberlain, chief economist at Glassdoor.
Skilled workers are having their telephones ring, and it's recruiters on the other end offering them positions. And so that sort of poaching activity, that shows up in the JOLTS report with more people quitting.
That's what happened to Stephanie Safara Bassel in Evanston, Illinois. She's leaving her job as an academic advisor in higher ed for a 23% pay bump to work in career services at another university.
I'll also be able to travel a little bit with this role, which is exciting for me.
Money was the big lure. She has a new baby and childcare costs are no joke. But she says the overall economy also played a role.
I felt kind of comfortable thinking about a change because I felt confident that jobs were opening up in a different way.
And the latest JOLTS report revealed others are feeling that confidence as well. In May, 3.6 million people quit their jobs. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Now, I have a fun new way for you to hear more about the quits rate. It's our new Alexa skill. If you've got an Echo or another Alexa device, just say, "Alexa, make me smart," and you'll hear a little explainer from either me or Kai Rizdahl. Try it out, and of course, say play Marketplace on any smart speaker. Coming up,
the fact is that the Emoji keyboard is the most installed keyboard in the world.
How emojis are changing the world one text at a time. But first, let's do the numbers. Not a great day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 219 points, 0.8% to close at 24,700. The NASDAQ fell 42 points, 0.5% to end at 77.16. And the S&P 500 shed 19.7% to finish at 27.74. Airlines were down. American Airlines tumbled 8%. It surprised analysts by cutting its second quarter revenue outlook. American says it is expecting slower fare growth in the U.S. Southwest Airlines gave up 0.8%. United Continental eased 3.3%. 21st Century Fox softened 3.9% after raising its offer for Britain's Sky. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.84%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. You heard about the good economy giving people the option to quit their jobs. But as you remember, 10 years ago, things weren't so good. We're headed now to South Euclid, Ohio, an outer suburb of Cleveland. It's part of our year-long series on the legacy of the financial crisis called Divided Decade. Like a lot of cities that were hit hard by foreclosures, South Euclid saw a lot of its housing stock bought up cheap by investors who thought they could flip them when the market got better. But it didn't, and a lot of those houses fell into disrepair. And some of those landlords started unloading houses through shady rent-to-own deals. The city has been trying to get to the bottom of those deals. Marketplace's Amy Scott brings us the story.
There's a picture of Sally Martin taped up in the housing department at South Euclid City Hall. She's standing in front of an abandoned house, knee-deep in grass, holding an oversized yardstick. The caption reads, "The Littlest Enforcer." Martin is small, just 4'11", with short blonde hair. And she didn't get that nickname by accident. When the housing bubble burst a decade ago,
there was a lot of predatory lending that went bad in our community.
So in 2008, the city of South Euclid hired its first housing director to make sure this middle-class community, with its good schools and low crime rate, didn't sink into a sea of abandoned homes and blight. Sally Martin got the job to enforce the city's housing code and keep South Euclid, South Euclid.
It's a great place to live. I live here myself. My husband grew up here.
Many lower-income families in the Cleveland area aspire to live here, too. And subprime mortgages with no money down and adjustable rates had allowed a lot of those families to trade up. What happened next is a familiar tale.
Over 20% of our stock ended up in foreclosure. Some streets had, you know, over 10%, sometimes 20% vacancy.
Before long, Martin started hearing about shady rent-to-own deals that illegally saddled would-be buyers with the responsibility for thousands of dollars in taxes and repairs.
We try to find out, you know, who's doing this, what's going on, and what the outcomes are. And unfortunately, the outcomes are usually terrible.
Martin takes me on a tour of South Euclid to show me just what terrible looks like. That's when we meet Maria Torres, whose rent-to-own house turned out to have 112 housing code violations.
We came in and we were like, ooh, this is going to be a big job.
A job Martin says should have been done by the landlord.
The law's very explicit. I think the question is how easy is it going to be to prosecute when many of the parties are not local.
And not easy to find. Maria Torres's landlord originally was Odell Roy LLC, a company owned by real estate investor Odell Barnes, based in South Carolina.
You may have already heard of Odell Barnes and the Barnes Method. Many news publications call him the foreclosure king.
The King's company bought Torres's house in 2016 for $14,000. But earlier this year, Martin discovered it had sold to another company for almost $85,000.
I don't know what that was. An accounting thing? I don't know.
Now Torres sends her rent to a third company. None of these companies would provide someone for an interview. And sometimes just tracking them down puts Martin in a tricky spot. It's her job to ensure the city's houses are up to code. But she also knows that going after the landlord could get Torres and her three kids evicted.
We find in code enforcement, we really do become social workers most of the time. You know, it just becomes a job full of a lot of human drama.
We stop in front of a small white house on a quiet street with a stroller parked in front. A refrigerator blocks one of the living room windows. Martin says the house has 40 code violations and is supposed to be vacant, but a woman is living there with several kids under a contract Martin says is illegal. This time, the landlord was arrested, but Martin was back in that same tricky situation.
Well, he's not willing to make the repairs, so my guess is that he's going to end up evicting her.
The woman facing eviction is Maureen Seymour, who answers the door holding her baby granddaughter.
Hi.
Seymour works two low-wage restaurant jobs, and she's on the hook for at least $30,000 in repairs and another $8,000 in unpaid property taxes.
I think I'm just going to work on them a little bit at a time and look for somewhere else to live.
And then just walk away?
Yep.
And lose the $25,000 she's invested.
These types of arrangements tend to victimize people who feel that they don't have any other choice. And it's absolutely tragic.
Martin and her team have made progress fighting blight in South Euclid, and median home prices have risen more than 50% in the past 6 years. But even a decade later, South Euclid's littlest enforcer is still trying to dig out from the crisis she was brought on to contain. In South Euclid, Ohio, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You can find all of our divided decade coverage in one handy location. It is marketplace.org/divided decade. Shifting gears completely now to emoji. They are a huge part of how we all communicate, but not yet a huge moneymaker. There is a standards body in charge of approving new emoji. It's called the Unicode Consortium. Recently, it approved more than 150 new images. There is a redheaded person, a llama, toilet paper, even bagels. It's a big deal if you're a redheaded llama farmer. But what's also interesting is that once the emoji are approved and Unicode says, you know, you can have toilet paper, then it's up to Apple or Microsoft or Google to design what the TP looks like. They become a little exercise in branding. But no money changes hands in any of this. Jeremy Burge is chief emoji officer for Emojipedia, which is kind of like Merriam-Webster for emoji. Jeremy, thanks for joining us.
Hey, no worries. Good to be here.
So I have this kind of basic question, which is, does anybody make money off of emoji?
Yes and no. Some people do. There are companies out there that do make money, but the emojis you see on your phone, I guess, they're not really a money-making product. The companies make them and support them to sell devices, really.
People don't necessarily make money off of creating a letter, but they might make money off of creating an entire font. Like, do you see a time when someone might create an emoji typeface?
Yeah, I mean, that is a real thing. That's how they're implemented on phones. I guess we think of them as pictures, but on most phones today, they are sitting there in a font that looks different on every phone. They're not yet interchangeable on your phone. You can't yet say, oh, I want to use this emoji font or that emoji font, but that could be potentially a huge market if people wanted to go down that path.
There are examples of companies interpreting emoji in different ways for sort of their own marketing purposes, right?
Every company, they try and do it their own way. So I guess Google recently, they've decided that they're going to take the egg out of the salad. They've said that, you know, that they've got a green salad emoji and it currently has an egg. And they're saying, we're going to get rid of that, make it vegan friendly. So I guess it's a way of companies expressing their own values in emoji form, where Apple a few years ago changed the gun emoji to look like a water pistol or a squirt gun. And now other companies are doing that too. So it's kind of an interesting area where a company gets to express some thoughts about what they think about the world in the little picture format.
Is that kind of right now there are only the two big players, I guess. There's basically Android and iOS. But is it weird that they're not cross-compatible?
Yeah, a lot of people wonder, you know, like, why if I send an emoji of this smiley face when I send it to another type of phone, does it look different? And I guess people often ask me, you know, why don't we just have one set? But whose set would that be? Would Apple be happy to just use Google's set? I don't think so. They're competitors. So they want any edge that they can have. And if it just comes down to emoji design, if they think that's an edge that they have, then they're going to take advantage of that. But who knows? Right. Maybe if there's money to be made in future, there could be an app store for emojis where you can have your own look and feel, where Disney potentially could have all the emojis look like Disney characters. I could see that being huge and could work with the current standard.
Yeah. See, that's going to happen now just because we've talked about it. Tell me why broadly, you know, I mean, emoji are unbelievably popular. They're kind of developing into their own language. Tell me why emoji are important, kind of in this, you know, in the grand scheme of everything that's happening in the world. Why is this thing so important to people?
You know, it seems frivolous on the outside. Sometimes people, you know, in my job documenting what the emojis look like and how they're used, people sort of think of it as a frivolous topic. But in a way, it's like the dictionary is keeping up with how trends in language and how we're communicating. I think it is interesting to document how people use emojis over time. And the fact is that the emoji keyboard is the most installed keyboard in the world. So I think that alone makes it an important factor that if a company does change, even if it is the egg in the salad, if they change one small thing, that's affecting billions of phones around the world. That's what gives it power over, say, a downloadable app or something that only some people have. This is affecting everybody when you make a change.
Well, and when you look at it kind of as a language, as sort of a pictographic language, I mean, could it be the new Esperanto? Anybody can communicate this way.
I love the idea of communicating only in emoji. I mean, I've tried it before and it's a horrific task trying to, if you take away all aspects of language and you're just left with emoji, you end up, it's a mess. I mean, it's a great complement to existing languages, but I don't really see the day where we can just send emojis back and forth and have a meaningful conversation about our families or our lives or what do you want to do this weekend? I think it'd end up being pretty basic conversations if we took the letters off the keyboard anyway.
Jeremy Burge is Chief Emoji Officer for Emojipedia. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. Good to speak to you.
The This final note before we go, you know, I had this whole plan to do a whole thing about England and France in the final of the World Cup. I was going to call it the Hamilton final. I was even going to sing, but apparently I jinxed it because Croatia won. And now you get Kylie Jenner. According to a cover story in Forbes magazine this month, Kylie is about to become the youngest self-made billionaire in history. The magazine says she's made some $900 million in just 3 years off her Kylie Cosmetics line. And yes, she owns 100% of the company. She turns 21 in August, so whenever she hits the big B, she can celebrate with champagne, I guess. All right, we got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was off 219 points. The NASDAQ down 42 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 shed 19 points. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday excellently engineered this program for us. I am Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. Don't worry, he's back again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.